Good afternoon. It's Monday, the 7th of August 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, Mike Robinson. Well, quite often, Mike, people are saying to us, UK Column giving fantastic news, a lot of detail, a lot of information, but give us some good news. I think we've got some good news today. And of course, the subject is the clampdown on the internet and alternative media sites.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to start off with this, which is the process of filling in landing cards. You know, those cards you used to have to fill in on the aircraft before you landed in the UK, if you were a foreign national or, you know, UK national heading to the United States or whatever. That's going to be scrapped. Everything's going digital. So the government is about to start gathering more data. Every way direction you look at the minute, the government is collecting more data. So that is good news, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay, let's move on. Okay, so that's good news. And well, it's particularly good news in the light, as you say, Brian, of the fact that this gent, Matthew Hancock, has decided that he's going to release this document, a new data protection bill, our planned reforms. This is a statement of intent, apparently. So the bill hasn't been published. We don't know exactly what it's going to say. We merely have a statement of intent at this point. So what are they saying? They're saying that people are going to have more control over their personal data. They're going to be better protected in the digital age under these new measures announced by Matthew Hancock. He says that under the plans, individuals will be allowed to, for example, they can withdraw consent. Brian, did you know we were able to withdraw consent?
I think I did, yes.
Yes, well, apparently this bill is going to allow us to withdraw consent. But look, let's have a look and see what Matthew Hancock had to say.
In the Queen's speech, we announced that we deliver on our manifesto commitment to bring forward a new data protection law to keep people's data safe online. Bill will support innovation and ensure we can remain confident our data is safe. It will give people more control over their data, including tougher rules on rights to access, move and delete data, and on needing people's consent to their use of data. And the bill will bring EU law into UK law, preparing us for Brexit.
So the bill is going to bring EU law into UK law, Brian, preparing us for Brexit. I thought the repeal bill was doing that, but apparently not. Apparently it's not doing that. The new data protection bill is going to do that, at least as regards to data. But everything that he said there was all about control of our data, consent over what's going on. So the new data protection bill, they say, is going to make it simpler to withdraw consent for the purpose for the use of personal data. It's going to allow people to ask for their personal data held by companies to be erased. So this is the so-called right to be forgotten on the internet. Enable parents and guardians to give consent for their child's data to be used. Require explicit consent to be necessary for processing sensitive personal data. Expand the definition of personal data to include IP addresses, internet cookies and DNA. Update and strengthen data protection law to reflect the changing nature and scope of the digital economy. Make it easier and free for individuals to require an organisation to disclose the personal data it holds on them. Make it easier for customers to move data between service providers. They're going to create a new criminal offence or new criminal offences, which are going to deter organisations from either intentionally or recklessly creating situations where someone could be identified from anonymised data. So, Brian, if we just go through a couple, because what I noticed with this list is that interspersed with the good news, which is apparently the fact that we have to give explicit consent for processing of sensitive personal data, things like expanding the definition of what is personal data to include IP addresses and so on. Well, first of all, this seems to imply a conflict between this Act of Parliament and the regulation of investigatory powers legislation, for example, which requires internet service providers to collect this information. So they're saying that the definition of personal data will include IP addresses, and we are going to be permitted to ask companies to delete that data. But the REPA says that they can't delete that data.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
I think they're in big trouble, Mike. And my opening statement about good news, I think we're beginning to see what the good news is, that these people at the moment are confused. They're running around in various directions. So one minute, the big threat of the internet is terrorism, and we're worried about domestic terrorists. Now, suddenly, it's the language is all switched to the fact that they're going to do everything they can to respect our consent and remove data when they've already introduced laws for the collection of that data. I think we're watching chaos, and I think this chaos is arising because of the success of people using the internet to research and expose what these idiots are really up to.
Right. So there's that kind of conflict going on there. But then number three here, enable parents and guardians to give consent for their child's data to be used. Now, that wasn't permitted before. So this is enabling more data to be collected, this time on children, people who clearly don't have the legal status to give consent on their own, but the parents can now give consent. So children's information can be gathered up. The other one that struck me was make it easier for customers to move data between service providers. So what they're doing here is they're creating a market in the same way that they did for energy. Or for insurance, compare the market and all these stupid comparison websites.
A market in data.
They're now going to create a market in data where you can switch who holds your data whenever you like.
And that is an extremely interesting point, because a little bit later we're going to be having a look at stuff that's been going on around the Information Commissioner herself, and we will come on to that topic.
So related to this, and if you listened to last night's Sunday Wire, Patrick Henningsen and I were discussing this issue related to that is, this headline sums it up. This is from Global Research. The truth war is being lost to a global censorship apparatus called Google. And of course, it is the big tech companies who are probably going to be receiving requests, most requests from people under the right to be forgotten. But this article making the point that, as we did last night, as Google is more or less a monopoly, a Facebook more or less monopoly, same with Twitter, that we're finding that censorship is being driven through these large tech companies. And this article really making the point that it's not just smaller organizations like us, but actually some organizations with pretty big viewerships that are seeing significant downturns in their viewing figures. Anything from 20% to 65% downturn in people's in websites' viewing figures as a result of what appears to be direct censorship by the search engines. And the point that they're making here is that a huge number of people rely on search results, organic search results, to find the information that they need. Now, Google, just a few weeks ago, I believe, was fined a significant amount of money. I think it was about €2.5 billion by the European Union under antitrust law, because they were putting their own business interests ahead of everybody. So it wasn't a level playing field for everybody. And one of the interesting little quotes from this article, I'll just put it back up on screen here, is from the Peter Thiel, the co-founder of PayPal, a major investor in Facebook, and he said, all happy companies are different. Each one earns a monopoly by solving a unique problem. All failed companies are the same. They fail to escape competition. It's a very important point that Google has escaped competition, and the powers that be, the governments around the world, have permitted that to happen. They've managed to build themselves a monopoly. And, for anybody that's saying, well, use an alternative search engine, well, actually it isn't possible, because if you go to DuckDuckGo or Startpage or some of these other alternative search engines, they're actually using Google's data as the source of their. So they're anonymizing your search, but they're using Google's data. So if Google's algorithms are penalizing companies like Global Research or us or 21st Century Wire, then going to an alternative doesn't help.
We need to remember here, of course, David Cameron's relationship with Google, in that the godmother of his son was the European president of Google. So we've seen these very close relationships between giants like Google and the British political system. We've now got all of this coming out about data. Who drove it? Was it Google driving it through the back door? Was this debated in Westminster? I don't think it was.
No, I think the point we made last night was that this is being driven from government through the tech companies. And we have to go back to David Cameron's United Nations speech about so-called extremism to see where the source of this is.
Right. Well, let's have a look at what the BBC's been reporting on the subject. So this is the same headline, but it's been changing, indeed changing this morning while we've been preparing the news. So UK data protection laws to be overhauled, and one image you would have found on screen is targeting Facebook, I think. And the other one has got Dell. Presumably that's either delete or it's Dell computers, which is a bit unfortunate. But anyway, there we are. The BBC is right into it. And why are we interested in the headline? Well, if we read in through the article, we come up with the Information Commissioner herself, Elizabeth Denham. And she said that we are pleased the government recognises the importance of data protection, its central role in increasing trust and confidence in the digital economy, and the benefits the enhanced protection will bring to the public. So this is all good news, Mike. They're saying it's all about benefits, it's all about protection, it's all about boosting the so-called digital economy. And as you've just pointed out, we need not worry because we can always withdraw our consent, in which case Google will do everything we ask.
Yes.
Yes. OK. Well, Elizabeth Denham, very interesting lady, Canadian. And is that significant? I believe it is, that we suddenly bring in a Canadian into this very powerful position. We've already got Mark Carnage in the Bank of England from Canada. So it appears that we're not good enough to run the country ourselves. We need to bring in people from overseas. And this lady is so good that she's won an award from this organisation. In fact, I'll restate this. She's appeared on their list of the most powerful data processing people in the country. So she's here top right, in third position in this particular assessment. But very interesting to see that the most powerful man, according to this organisation, is Andy Day, Chief Data Officer from Sainsbury's.
Absolutely.
So we're bringing in the supermarkets, who are the people who have actually got the immense power in the country around data, but there's also Unilever. They've also got Stephen Dedman, a little bit unfortunate, Global Deputy Chief Privacy Officer of Facebook, James Morgan of British Gas. So I found it interesting that the Information Commissioner that we would expect to have some detachment from the heart of companies making money out of data is in a figurative sense in bed with these people. And it isn't just a question that they've said, we think you're a good egg and you're doing a good job, Elizabeth. No, she's up on their site and she's got quite a lot to say here. She says that before her appointment as the UK Information Commissioner, she held senior regulatory positions in the field of information rights in Canada. She also served as Information and Privacy Commissioner for British Columbia, so that's good. Assistant Privacy Commissioner of Canada in Ottawa, responsible for enforcing Canada's commercial privacy law. So we know which side of the fence she was on there. And she started her work in the Office of Information and Privacy Commissioner in Alberta, where she served as Director of Enforcement. So here she is boasting of her powers with a whip, really, to keep people under control. But she's Canadian and somehow she's brought into the country. We'll come on to that, but let's just follow through on how this Data IQ award system works. And I just wanted to flag up some of the people making the decisions. So we've got Kate Tay, Group Legal Director of The Telegraph. We've got James Morgan of Sainsbury's. We've got a Mark Chipperfield, Head of Data Management, BBC. More on him in a minute. Stacey Max, Tesco, Boots, Royal Mail, Dyson, EDF, and Channel 4, And down at the bottom, we've got a bank.
Yeah, but hold on a second. Didn't you say that the person in the number one position was the chief data officer for Sainsbury's?
Yes, I did, yes.
And so Sainsbury's is represented on the panel of judges?
Well, the panel, I believe, changes, and it's not quite clear who the people were on the panel at which particular time. So I think we're giving an illustrative look at who's who here.
Right, okay.
But it's absolutely fascinating if we just spend a little more time. So here's the lady herself. And, of course, we now know that she's quite well connected with Data IQ. Who is Data IQ? Well, we had a little look, and in fact, they are IQ DDG Limited. And that is being run by two particular individuals. We've got Peter Anthony Geldes here. That's two Pauls, there's your name. Peter Anthony Paul Geldes and Adrian Charles Gregory. Now, they've got a number of different companies to do with data. So the people running Data IQ are themselves making money out of the control legislation around data or the sharing of data. And of course, they put together the selection team to choose and promote winners across the country, including Elizabeth herself. But I found it fascinating that we did have Mark Chipperfield, head of data management BBC, as part of that team. And what's his role? His role is actually making sure the BBC gets its full lump sum on TV licensing. So he boasts on the Data IQ page that his job is to make sure that everybody pays for their TV license.
Good.
None of that, of course, is declared by the BBC in reporting in their report on the Information Commissioner and the change in the data laws.
Yeah.
So this again is two-faced reporting by the BBC. They've got an interest, but they don't tell you that interest in their own reporting. And if you'd like to know more of this man, well, here's some of the details. We'd just better label him BBC, of course. But down at the bottom, he says, in every year he worked there, the BBC has been facing challenges to its 3.6 billion income from the licence fee. Ensuring it collects the maximum revenue is the optimal way has seen Chipperfield oversee the work of identifying the small percentage of people who will not pay for the right to watch TV.
So you got to pay for your rights, Brian.
We got to pay for your rights. So there's no. You may opt out if you want to. Here, many people like to opt out. So this is very aggressive language, and this man is clearly spying on people who he believes are not paying the TV license.
Yeah.
So there we are, the BBC figuratively in bed with the Information Commissioner. But let's bring her back in and we'll go down a different route. So there's the panel. And one of the people on this particular selection panel is Brian Price from Aldermore Bank. If you haven't heard of those, we did a little bit of work as to where the money's come from, a few tens of million from Goldman Sachs, AnaCap Financial Partners, that'd be a hedge fund,
yeah.
Mike, I would think. Honeywell Capital Management.
Hedge fund.
Hedge fund, but also with a Honeywell label, I would imagine that this is pretty close to data. And the Ohio Public Employees Retirement System. I always find it interesting where you see public pension funds at work in other areas. Where can we go from that? Well, it gets fascinating because we found this lady, Danuta Gray, Senior Independent Director and Non-Executive Director of the bank. Why are we interested in her? Well, because that links her straight back to the British government. So we've got the Information Commissioner herself working with big data interests that are backed by enormous wealth and banks. But that brings you in a circle round to the British government. So let's have a look at the government webpage. And here she is, Danuta Gray. And this is what it says. It says that she's non-executive defence board member and chair of the People Committee. The People Committee supports the board in overseeing appointments and the processes for, quote, managing the careers of senior military officers and senior civil servants, including managing talent, behaviour and incentives. It supports the work of the Permanent Undersecretary of Defence and the Chief of the Defence Staff. This sounds like something out of the Soviet Union, the People Committee.
So this used to be called the Appointments Committee, and in 2015 it was renamed the People Committee. But isn't it staggering that they are managing the talent, managing the behaviour of senior British military officers, and of course they're managing incentives, so the incentives will help manage the behaviour, right?
One would have thought so. And of course, this is where the moment we look at the Cabinet Office that was controlling the insights, the behavioural insights team, we now know that the mechanism is in place for controlling people's behaviour, reframing that behaviour. But we have a woman connected with international banking interests that is, quote, managing the career of senior military officers. Now, we haven't unfortunately got David Ellis with us on today's programme, but I wonder what he will have to say. I'd also like to know what senior military people would say. Are they aware that we've now got to the state where it's the banks more or less directly that are running senior military personnel? And to emphasise the point about the people committees, just let's have a look at this lady, Catherine Brown. So we chose her. We could have taken several others, but she was appointed as non-executive member of the Cabinet Office Board. That sounds almost like a company, Mike, doesn't it? The Office Board in November 2015. She's also chair of the Cabinet Office People Committee. An independent non-executive director, Catherine served as Group Strategy Director of Lloyds Banking Group until October 2015. Prior to that, she was Executive Director, Human Resources of the Bank of England, which, of course, is not the national bank, as many people believe. So even when we go to the chair of the Cabinet Office People Committee, we're straight back into banking interests. So this is a pretty dangerous situation, and none of this fully declared to the public.
But all pretty incestuous with surrounding the Information Commissioner. And, well, we'll see where this legislation takes us once it's published.
Indeed. We'll show, before I pass back to you, Mike, we'll just show this example of data at work. Somebody kindly sent us in this article from the Liverpool Echo. It's talking about Liverpool putting in specialist teams alongside vulnerable families that haven't got jobs. And we can trust these people because they're going to work with individual families. Lots of money available to get those experts alongside the families, but no money available, of course, to help the families in the first place. But they're going to come in. They're going to obviously be getting very, very detailed knowledge about the families, because essentially they're going to be living and working alongside them. And that information is going to be hoovered up by the Department for Work and Pensions. And so
they're going to enjoy the benefits of work.
Well, indeed. So this is a letter that was sent in to us as well. We've just anonymised it, but it's a very real letter. And what this letter is showing is that when a member of the public has said to the DWP, oh, no, you don't, you're not going to hoover up my data, they've suddenly had to backpedal and they've had to remove that data. So in regards to our meeting on Monday, the 24th of July, concerning the referral to the voluntary group work course with People Plus, I've received confirmation that the survey you completed has been destroyed at source. And what I deduce from this letter, Mike, is that the person didn't realise what was happening, that they were asked or encouraged to do something. They then realised the DWP was hoovering up information. They've taken them to task. And then the middle paragraph there says, just to confirm, all the answers to the questions the claimant gave have been deleted. And she's also been marked as disagree regarding taking part in the research. So she will not be contacted by DWP or the external research company. The original encrypted email that was triggered by you pressing the buttons on the RAT, the random allocation tool, has also been deleted, so we hold no details around how the claimant answered the questions. So this is a very encouraging text because it shows that when somebody stands up and says, no, you're not doing it, they make progress. But of course, you were quite correct, Mike, because here's the quote by David Gok, who's Secretary of State for Work and Pensions. He says, with respect to this trial, this pilot is yet another step forward in our efforts to help people of all backgrounds enjoy the benefits of work and will boost the wide-ranging support we currently offer through local experts, Job Centre Plus. I read that, helping people enjoy the benefits of work, and into my mind came the gates for the concentration camps and freedom via work. There's something very, very nasty going on here.
Okay. Well, we had hoped not to take a summer break this year, but unfortunately circumstances mean that we have to. So to give you a little bit of warning, there will be no UK column news from the 14th until the 30th of this month. So other things will be going on, I'm sure, but we're going to take a two-week break, two and a bit week break this year. So that's it, really.
That is it. And we will be back and we will be on the case of UK news subsequently.
Absolutely. And we should mention that because that, unfortunately, that period falls over the normal time for our monthly meeting, there'll be no monthly meeting this month in the George. Please be aware of that as well.
As Mike, I'll just add, seeing the aircraft there reminds me of my flight to the States last year or the year before, whenever it was. And of course, I did get one of those questionnaires on the plane, which asked me if I was a terrorist or had ever been a terrorist. And it also said that any questions about the immigration procedures, be sure to speak to the helpful Homeland Security people. Which I did. That was very badly received indeed, but I was iris scanned and warned that if I didn't shut up, I would likely be on the next plane back from America. So if anybody is not sure as to how this thing is building at the moment, that was probably a very good example.
Yeah. Okay. Well, good news, Brian. The Northern Police Investigation Centre has opened. Do you know what a police investigation centre is?
I believe it's nothing to, this is my guess, Mike, it's nothing to do with the police. I think this will be staffed by civilians.
This is a very good point. So the Home Secretary has opened the new police investigation centre in Hampshire, and she opened it over the weekend, or just before the weekend rather. The centre forms part of the police force's plans for modern facilities to help support the work of officers across Hampshire. This is what Amber Rudd had to say. Police officers and staff in Hampshire and across the country do a fantastic job keeping us all safe. Crimes traditionally measured by the independent survey for England and Wales have fallen by more than a third since 2010. I am really pleased to open the new investigation centre in Basingstoke because having modern facilities is in the right locations means more officers' time is spent where it matters most, on the front line, doing vital work to reduce crime in our communities. So there you go. Well, apparently this centre is going to provide a secure environment and has been designed to enable people to be processed more effectively, so frontline police officers can return to duty quicker. So basically they waltz in with their recently arrested victim and they pass them over to, I suspect, as you say, private staff, where they're then put into these delightful custody suites here, as you can see on screen. Of course, that's a computer model. That's not the real thing. There are no pictures from inside just at the moment. Goodness knows what. There could be, handcuffs, attached to the walls for all we know.
Well, one thing we do know, Mike, is that Melanie Shaw, who remains in solitary confinement, is certainly not in a cell that is that big, or a custody suite that's that big.
Well, indeed. The building is going to have 36 cell secure facilities to accommodate approximately 350 investigators and related teams working on a shift basis. Now, the key point here is The buildings have facilities that support a centralised investigation hub with investigators and specialist teams working together in the same space. What it doesn't mention in that sentence is the word police. There are no word policeman or police officer. So we don't know what type of investigators these are. We don't know what type of specialist teams they are, but apparently this way of working with different teams sharing the same space means more efficiency and offers quicker handovers for arresting officers. And then they said the new centres have been created to in part reduce the amount of time frontline officers spend in custody suites. That is, there are considerable benefits to the community in relevant teams sharing the same space within one building. So they keep reiterating this point. This again comes back to this multi-agency approach. But in this case, I suspect it's more a mixture of public and private agencies rather than public agencies coming together.
Everybody integrated together. So there's no separation of powers within the public sector or with the public sector and the commercial sector.
And if you look at the frequently asked questions for this, the one that really caught my eye was, is the centre a police station? And the answer is, an investigation centre is not a police station. However, there will be a property centre attached to the main building with a front counter for any property-related inquiries. So
I had to chuckle at that point. I did have to chuckle.
Yes.
It's not a police station. And don't worry about what we're doing here, because if you've lost a bit of clothing, you can come to the front desk.
Yes. And get it sorted out. So there you go. I don't get a warm feeling from this, Brian. This goes beyond just having modern facilities.
Well, and the other thing, of course, that will be integrated with this is the mental health teams. And therefore, you have integrated the psychiatric system. And we know from numerous examples now of people being put into that psychiatric system if they're causing trouble for the British state.
Yeah. Well, speaking of trouble for the British state and sticking with policing, the Express and Star here from the Midlands is making the point that West Midlands police are to end up with 800 extra taser trained police. So, you know, anybody outside the UK may be more used to having police armed in some capacity. But in Britain, of course, we have always had a tradition of unarmed police, but police are being armed more and more. And in this case, we are adding 800 extra taser officers to West Midlands Police. That brings the total up to 1,400. So that's more than a doubling.
Yeah. Well, this is arming the police a step at a time, isn't it? Because, of course,
absolutely,
the taser is a lethal weapon, and anybody who thinks it isn't is grossly misguided. Have a look at the overall deaths from tasers. Have a look at the initial report done by the doctor. Can't remember his name, but he was from Birmingham Heartlands Hospital, where he listed at the end of the report all of the ways in which a taser could produce a serious injury or death. So it's bringing tasers as something which is sort of relatively insignificant, and then drift in the armed police on top. And we reported a week ago that the National Police Chiefs Council is already debating the need to have Britain's police fully armed.
Well, and in fact, in this case, they also mentioned the fact that the tasers that they're using are going to be upgraded from single shot model to a dual shot model. So this avoids them having to reload in between, because they're complaining that the original taser had a 60% failure rate. So now they're getting a dual shot, so that if one fails, they can fire the next one.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Presumably the taser company still makes the profit, even though the thing is defective. Mm. Well, if that's the situation, we're arming Britain's police. I find this a very amusing headline. Express revealed plans for EU Army, Navy and Air Force deployable without national MP's approval. It's like this is a scoop by the Express, but of course, the UK column has been warning about this for years.
Yeah.
I was going to say months, but of course it's years. But the article itself, what's it got to say? Well, it says that a dossier compiled by the Liberal Aldi grouping, I don't know whether that's a play on the supermarket, it's got an E instead of an I, but it's headed by Brexit negotiator Guy Verhofstadt, and it's calling for EU integrated military forces to intervene on behalf of the bloc across the globe. So it says that Brussels needs autonomous military capabilities with their own budget under the direct command of the EU, and it will wear the EU ensign into battle. So this is the super state coming into to being. The paper says, well, the document's got no official weight, but of course it is a document being pushed through by Mr. Verhofstadt and his team in order to push policy. It says that liberal parties should be calling on member states to progressively provide the EU with urgently needed defence capability. And it says at the very end goal, the roadmap would aim at building a supranational military force. The roadmap would be realised under the lead and political responsibility of EU CO President, with implementation roles of the European Defence Agency, the European Commission and the EU member states. So, Mike, this is the beast now starting to emerge. The plan always was for it to be a supranational state. That's what the European Union is and always was planned to be. Now we can see the formation of the military, and the British military is not being pulled clear of this organisation. Theresa May lying on a daily basis as Britain's armed forces are being given to this supranational system. So many would call it treason. We just bring her on screen to emphasise the point, sticking with the Express here. But we've now got the situation where apparently the EU that we're giving our military to is threatening us and threatening to punish us if we don't pay them enough money. This is part of the hype and rhetoric to get us to believe that Theresa May is actually doing something. We would say she's lying and continues to lie over Brexit.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, really good news, Brian, because the HMS Queen Elizabeth Carrier has been so successful on its sea trials, it's heading into Portsmouth within the next 2 weeks. Now, they don't know exactly when it's going to go to Portsmouth. It's going to be sometime in about 2 weeks, because weather conditions might mean that the exact date of the historic moment is yet to be confirmed. So what did Michael Fallon have to say? He said, in just 2 weeks' time, the most powerful warship ever built for Britain's famous Royal Navy is set to sail into her proud new home in Portsmouth, where we'll skip the deployment bit and turn it straight into a museum. Well, of course, he didn't say that last little bit, did he? But, you know, he is hoping to have three F-35s on board by next summer to start flight training.
So three F-35s,
yeah,
in order to dominate the globe.
Yes, yes.
And,
well,
and this aircraft carrier is to be sent to the South China Seas to intimidate the Chinese.
Yeah, but
with three aircraft or?
No. No, I don't think so. So when they're in a position to actually intimidate the Chinese, is sometime between 20 years and never, I guess. Yeah. But apparently this 65,000-ton aircraft carrier is going to be the flagship for the next 50 years. But what the other thing that interested me about this, Brian, because I hadn't come across the name before, was that these aircraft carriers are being delivered by the Aircraft Carrier Alliance. So here it is. There is the Aircraft Carrier Alliance. It's got an F-35 on their website. They're very proud of it. And these are being delivered by the Aircraft Carrier Alliance, a unique partnering relationship between BAE Systems, Babcock, Thales, and the UK Ministry of Defence. And so, you know, I hadn't come across it before, but it goes beyond being just another public-private partnership, because this is the integration of...
Well, this is the procurement arm of the European Union, but it's been done very cleverly, because the initial partnership, of course, was with the French. So Thales in there,
yeah,
as the French component. This is the creation of a full unified EU military, which includes the weapons systems and the treasury and the procurement, as we're seeing with the procurement of this carrier. And I would also say that probably if we and other agencies hadn't put pressure on what was really happening, we would see joint manning with the French of this aircraft carrier.
Yeah,
I'm going to say I believe we've had an impact, and they cannot do that at the moment.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's go to the United Nations then, and the World Humanities Conference, which began yesterday and lasts all this week. It's all about challenges and responsibilities for a planet in transition. Did you know that we were a planet in transition? Who's driving this transition? What is the transition? These are questions that spring to mind. But what is the main focus of this World Humanities Conference? Well, it says Liège will host the World Humanities Conference from Sunday the 6th to Saturday the 12th, co-organised by UNESCO, the International Council for Philosophy and Human Sciences, and the World Humanities Conference Foundation. This Congress will gather about 1,800 participants from all over the world, working in the fields of science, politics, art and communication, as well as representatives of international governmental and non-governmental organisations. The title of the conference is World Humanities Conference, Challenges and Responsibilities for a Planet in Transition. And you look at the details of the agenda, and it's all about mass migration, global migration, and breaking down nation states. So cultural identities, cultural diversities, and intercultural relations, a global multicultural humanity is what they're aiming for, a global multicultural humanity. So they're talking about interdisciplinary approaches to cultural identity and its components, cultural identity and the diversity of dynamic perspective, diversity in dynamic perspective, internal analysis of interculturalism, dynamic analysis of interculturalism, and so it goes on. Then they have a whole section on borders and migrations that begins with a conceptual analysis. And then they have a session called Borderscape, Borders as Organization of Space, Tracing and Marking. The dynamics of international migration, they're going to have a session on. And they're going to have a session on migration, culture and values. And then they'll have a session on the humanities in a changing world. What changes the world and in the world, what changes the humanities and in the humanities, whatever that means. And they're talking about digital worlds and the new research landscape and digital everything. So, but the main focus of it, global migration, breaking down national homogeneity, breaking down nation states, breaking down borders.
And that, of course, was the policy being pushed across by Peter Sutherland. So when we look at the migration from Europe, this is planned. This is not ordinary people on the move out of their own interest. This is actually planned and orchestrated.
And then just to finish, I wanted to mention Oliver Stone, because he's posted a very interesting post to his Facebook page. He says, Congress passed its beloved Russia sanctions last week by a vote of 419-3. The Senate followed with a vote of 98-2. Can we not even accept the possibility that perhaps our intelligence agencies are not doing their job and maybe, just maybe, are deliberately misleading us to continue their false flag war against Russia?
Well, brilliant statement.
Rather surprising from somebody like Oliver Stone, but perhaps not. For that matter, that Russia itself may not be that invested in screwing up our vaunted democracy with such sloppy malware as claimed, especially in view of the strong statement put out by veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, a group of reform-minded veterans throwing a dose of acid on the infamous Brennan Clapper report of January the 6th, 2017, and so it goes on. I just wanted to mention it and suggest that everybody has a read of the full text, because it's extremely interesting. He makes some fantastic points, and it should be shared probably.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I'll just say that I think I confused in commenting on the carrier. I may have confused some of our audience today in saying three. I was referring to the F-35 jets, three F-35s to go on board the carriers.
Initially, in 12 months or so.
In 12 months or so, to be fully operational by 2020 or so. Two carriers, of course. Just clear up that confusion. And the other thing is that in our chat room, somebody's pointing a finger very heavily at the UN and UNESCO in particular. And of course, pointing out that if you look at where the funding is coming from for these EU world global policies, then you are coming to people such as Soros and the Rockefellers and the other big banking interests. So the United Nations policy we know is coming into UK straight in at local government level without going anywhere near Westminster. Mm. Where does that policy come from, paid for by the international banksters? Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. And don't forget, UK Column will be away for 2 weeks from this coming Friday. Thanks for joining us. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.